Whoever You Are Now, You Are Home. Written by Black Cat. Read by Flower Parish and K-Burb. This is a Star Wars fic, rated for teen and up audiences. And it is part one of the Today You Will Meet a Beautiful Stranger series. The radio stops working 10 minutes before they hit the Temple City limits. Django, sitting in the front seat of Jaster's ancient sedan, mutters a curse that Jaster pretends not to hear, leaning forward to fiddle with the dial. He raises a fist, and without looking over, Jaster warns, "If you thump it, be advised that I reserve the right to thump you." Freezing, Django slants him a peeved look, then says, "Someone would defend me." "Ha," Arla says, popping her gum. She has her bare feet kicked up on the backrest of Django's seat, the rear windows down all the way, and her Game Boy in front of her face. Jaster hasn't been ignored this hard since she was 15. "Don't look at me," Miles says, before Django can do more than glance at him in the rearview mirror. "I would have to be able to move to save you." "You can move," Jaster defends, because he was the one who stuck the box of books on Miles's lap, and it's not that heavy. He even made sure it was mostly binders and loose folders, rather than his reference books. Because Miles is petty and a bastard, no matter how hard he pretends to be otherwise, the box he's holding thumps hard against the back of Jaster's seat. Then, just to drive his point home, he does it twice more. "Do not make me turn this car around," Jaster says. "Please make him turn this car around," Django says loudly. "At least the university never made you move all the way into the middle of a desert." Miles groans. "If he turns the car around, we have to go back through the desert and unpack. Jaster, keep driving or I'll tell them about Keldabe." "You will not," Jaster protests, just as Arla lowers her Game Boy for the first time in almost 200 miles. "Keldabe," she says, with more interest than is good for Jaster's health. "Wait, is this an embarrassing story?" Django asks, abandoning his attempt to glare the radio into submission. "Miles," Jaster threatens, and levels a dark look at his best friend in the mirror. Miles raises his hands, half visible behind the box, and all the other boxes stacked up around him and Arla both. Jaster, maybe potentially, didn't need to bring quite so many books in the car, rather than waiting for the moving van that's following tomorrow, but there's no way he was trusting hired movers with his collection. "As long as we get to Coruscant before tomorrow, your secret is safe with me," he says, just as the radio crackles loudly enough to make Jaster twitch. The car swerves faintly, but thankfully there's no one else on the long, straight stretch of road that doesn't seem to have changed noticeably in the last 6 hours. "Django, turn that down," he says pointedly, and Django huffs and reaches for the dial.
"Was traffic,"
a woman's low, 30 voice says, soft and soothing and something strangely sweet.
"Just a reminder, the Secret Police have issued another arrest warrant for a woman who recently set fire to the Waffle House on Arkansas Street. She's about 5'2", with red hair and green eyes, and she's currently wanted on charges of littering."
Jester blinks, casting a confused glance at the radio like that will tell him if he heard that right. He couldn't have. Or maybe the host just got confused while she was reading the report. "Oh," Django says, disappointed. "Oh," Miles says, in an entirely different tone of voice. Deliberately, Arla lowers her Game Boy and gives him a deeply judgmental look over the top of her aviators. Miles narrows his eyes right back. "Community radio is a dying art," he says. "Django, don't change the station." Django, clearly smart enough not to challenge Miles, raises his hands in surrender and sits back. Arla, of course, isn't nearly so tactful, or maybe cowardly. "How about you leave us out of your voice kink?" she asks, arching one blonde brow at Miles. Miles scowls at her. Jaster, if you don't control your daughter... My daughter is 25 and more than capable of controlling herself, Jaster says, because he's also smart enough not to get in the middle of this. Well, usually. And also, I clearly need to drag you along on more family road trips if you think I could ever possibly control Arla and drive at the same time. This isn't a road trip. You're dragging us to another country for your research. The only reason I let you drag me along, Miles says, ignoring Django entirely, is because you would starve if I didn't remind you to eat, and as soon as Django gets himself arrested and Arla finds her way to the nearest lesbian bar, you're going to bury yourself in your books and not come out. Arla flashes a peace sign, pops her gum, and goes back to her game without arguing. Arrested, Django says, indignant. That's your default for me in a new town. That's always my default for you, Miles tells him. Jaster, that's a construction sign. Take the left lane. I see it. Jaster makes the detour, squinting against the evening sun. Then shadow falls, the road turning to take them through a low hill between two taller mountains that stand like sentinels in the golden desert. We should be fairly close at this point. If we are picking up the local radio, we can't be that far out. Miles shifts, turns sideways, and leans forward through the gap between the front seats, turning the radio up slightly. There's music playing, something soft but bright, but the melody is hard to catch. Jaster listens for a moment, but the beat always seems to change, never quite settles into something regular. He's never heard anything like it, and as they crest the hill, he finds the hairs on the back of his neck are standing up.
Close your eyes.
The woman on the radio says, low and sweet and just a little strange.
Let my words wash over you. You are safe now. Welcome to the temple.
Below them, starting at the foot of the hill and stretching out, the town of Temple is just starting to change with the lengthening evening. Lights are coming on, and the shapes of neat streets and green parks and distant hills are clear. Jaster finds his breath catching a little, even though he's seen thousands of towns like this. The radio host's words add something almost eerie to the atmosphere of it, though, and Jaster clearly isn't the only one who feels that way. Miles shifts, leaning forward, and Arla drops her Game Boy, then her feet, crossing her arms on the back of Django's seat and giving a low whistle. "That's home," she asks, and Django makes a quiet sound of agreement. Could have done a lot worse, old man, he says. What a quaint little town, Jaster says, half a second before a woman in white riding a giant cat with two tails runs them off the road. The police officer who comes to take their statements and oversee the tow truck pulling the car out of a large sand dune looks more like the kind of person Jaster would expect to see on the other side of a cell door, honestly. That sucks, man, is the officer's grand summation, and he hands Jaster back his papers without doing more than glancing through them. He isn't in uniform, though there's an old-fashioned police cap perched precariously on the top of his long dreads, and someone, maybe him, has helpfully pinned a "Hello, my name is" sticker on his sleeveless shirt with an oversized safety pin. It says Officer Voss, except Officer has been crossed out, and Quinlan has been written above it in yellow Sharpie. Jaster is fairly sure there isn't a single uniform regulation the man is following, and he takes the papers back without commenting, bemused. If it saves him a ticket for reckless driving, he isn't about to argue. Yes, well, no one was hurt, Jaster says, though Miles gives him a dirty look for it from where he's sitting at the base of a cactus. It's not Jaster's fault that he maybe elbowed Miles in the face in his rush to see what had been damaged. Most of his books in the car are first editions. Always a plus, Quinlan says, flashing him a grin. He's rather devastatingly attractive, though Jaster had rather thought he'd gotten over his thing for men in uniform when he was ejected from Conquered Dawn's army. Not that Quinlan is wearing a uniform. Mostly. Maybe that's the reason. His biceps really are very nice, Jaster thinks wistfully. It's been far too long since he had a date if he's checking out a man who can't be much older than Arla. I don't suppose I can convince you to skip the ticket this time, Jester asks, and because common sense has never precisely been his strong suit, he gives Quinlan a smile that several former partners have described as unfortunately charming. Given that we're new in town, I mean. Quinlan raises both brows, then smirks. Really? Be nice to have some new faces around, especially if they look like yours. Jester is vain enough to find that immensely flattering, even if it's a little trite. Well, I have to say, I'll certainly object less to a police presence if you're the one, Dad, Django says pointedly, just as Arla makes a gagging noise. Jester is going to leave his children in the desert and feel no shame in it. Thankfully, Quinlan just laughs, reaching up to tip his cap back. It is, Jester realizes, held in place by a beret with a big blue flower on it. I'll be around, he says. Probably. I think Nico gets us in the divorce this month, and he's usually big on community outreach. Jester has no idea what that means, and he blinks, opens his mouth. Before he can ask, though, the tow truck pulls forward, and with a clatter and an avalanche of sand, the sedan comes free. The truck drags it back up onto the road before the engine turns off, the door opens, and a slim woman in mechanic's overalls gets out. She is, Jester registers with disbelief, entirely, undeniably, blue. And she has two tentacles in the place of her hair. Quinn, she calls, sounding delighted, and approaches with quick steps. With a laugh, Quinlan catches her, hugs her tightly, and, if he thinks the fact that she's a color very close to cornflower is anything to be alarmed about, it certainly doesn't show. Hey, Ayla, he says, squeezing her. Nice goggles. Thank you, Thulm gave them to me, Ayla says with dignity, and pulls back, pushing her dark goggles a little further up her forehead. He says you've been missing dinner. Quinlan rolls his eyes. Dooku's month, he says, and Ayla sighs like that's everything she needs to know, and then slides out of his hold. I'll check your car, she tells Jester. But I didn't see any damage when I was hooking it up, except for the dent in the hood. You should be fine to drive into town. Jester can't manage to find a single solitary word that isn't blue anywhere in his expansive vocabulary. Thanks, Ayla, Quinlan says fondly, and reaches out to flick the leather and cloth head wrap, holding her tentacles back. You need to stop dipping your leku in oil. You're going to kill the nerves. That's an old wives' tale, Ayla counters, and heads for the sedan, pushing up the sleeves of her thermal shirt. Sorry, Quinlan says. She's my daughter. Kind of. Like, that's what there is to be concerned about here, Jester thinks, maybe a little hysterically. She's blue. She's blue? He manages. Quinlan lights up like Jester just complimented her hair. Right? Isn't she the perfect shade? Halfway between sky and cerulean. She's so pretty, I can't believe it sometimes. Jester's very last worry was about the name of that particular hue. Quinlan is already turning away, though, whistling as he heads for where Ayla has the sedan's hood open and is checking the engine. A gust of wind almost knocks his cap askew, and he puts a hand up to catch it, then pulls himself up on the back of the tow truck like he hasn't a care in the world, and certainly none about his daughter being Periwinkle. I was wondering when you'd notice, Miles says dryly, still sitting under the cactus. Jester takes four precise steps back and sinks down beside him, staring. From this angle, he can't see Ayla, but he's willing to bet that she's still blue. She's... Cyan, Miles offers, and Jester closes his eyes with a groan, rubbing at the forming headache behind his eyes. Think she's single? Arla asks interestedly, craning her neck to get another look as she tips her shades down. Isn't that too much butch in one relationship? Django asks, and Arla punches him in the shoulder hard. Don't stereotype, she tells him, and there's no such thing as too much butch. She's blue, Jester says. Dad, Arla says, deeply offended. Why are you hung up on that? Jester gives it up with a sigh, burying his face in his hands. They got run off the road by a woman riding a cat that had more teeth than a Tyrannosaurus, their local police officer is 9/10 of the way out of uniform, their mechanic is blue, and they haven't even gotten past the city limits yet. Jester has a headache, and it doesn't look to be fading anytime soon. Really? Jester asks, halfway through unpacking the handful of kitchen items he'd remembered to stow in the car between all the boxes of books. Miles doesn't look up from where he's setting up his ancient radio, lovingly maintained. If you're going to complain about my music after this whole nightmare of a trip, I get to clean the toilet bowl with your face. Jester huffs, plugging in the coffee pot with a little more force than is probably necessary. It would have been less of a nightmare if you'd driven your own car. He points out. It's an antique. I wasn't about to drive it across the desert. Miles glances up, one brow raised, and asks, Do you really object to my presence that much? I paid for half of the moving truck. I don't object, Jester says, and it's entirely the truth. He'd never object to Miles' presence in any part of his life. But breakups, we, Miles says firmly, are not talking about this. I'm not talking about this with you. Montross was someone I introduced you to.
The Temple City Council would like to remind everyone that Corbin Canyon and the Funerary Wastes are off limits to all citizens who cannot commune with ghosts or read the eddies of the universe in the passing of low clouds.
The same radio host as before says, Oh, thank God, Miles says, and turns the volume up. The strange sweetness of her voice gives Jester pause. It's still beautiful, still oddly captivating, but there's something off about it. Something that makes the hair on the back of his neck stand up, and he can't quite understand why. It's not a reaction of fear or hatred, just an awareness that there's something here that he can't see. Maybe he's just too used to television, Jester thinks. He needs to listen to more radio if he's getting spooked by not being able to see the speaker. Miles will be delighted by this resolution.
Of course,
the woman says, light, easy, amused in a way that strikes Jester as the same way a big cat is amused.
The true danger of Corbin Canyon is the temptation it poses, and one has to wonder if temptation is truly a danger in the grand scheme of this dark, wild universe. I tend to believe that life is all about seeing how close to temptation you can get without giving in. Swim with sharks while dressed like a seal. Dance on a tightrope without a safety net. Fly on wax wings towards the sun. Just don't forget what ties you to the earth, listeners. We all need something to come home to. We all need something to believe in when the temptation is gone.
Miles's breath is a little sharper than it should be, and he looks away before Jester can see his face.
And now,
the woman says, much brighter.
The weather.
Even Miles winces slightly at the high-pitched wail of too many saxophones playing high notes, and he turns the volume back down, then sighs a little, leaning back against the counter. What about you? He asks, watching Jester carefully. Moving two countries over to study the remnants of an ancient religious sect that practiced human sacrifice isn't exactly the midlife crisis that most people have. Jester smiles ruefully, setting the clock on the coffee maker and then turning. He pulls himself up onto the counter, leaning back against the cupboards, and takes a moment. The house is wide and empty and almost cavernous without anything in it. It feels too large, like he's a pebble rattling around in an empty oil drum, but Concord Dawn felt very small, and it's not precisely an objectionable change. I don't think I'm allowed to call it a midlife crisis again, he says. Considering that when I had my first one, I adopted two of my colleagues' children and got myself ejected from the military. You got yourself drummed up on murder charges is what you did, Miles says, but the curve of his mouth is wry. And that wasn't a midlife crisis, that was just a crisis. It was self-defense, Jester counters, and that's what the judge found. It counts. But yes, likely just a crisis. He pauses for a long moment, considering, and then drags a hand through his hair, trying not to think of his tiny corner office at the university, the weight of too many sleepless nights, and then... well, it wasn't life-ending, but Tor certainly knew precisely where to hit to make things hurt the most. "A change of scenery could do us both some good, I think," he says, rueful, and Miles snorts in resigned amusement. "You'd better have brought wine glasses in that box," he says. Jaster leans over to fish them out. "I seem to remember that at one time we drank out of old jam jars and didn't bat an eye. When did we get stuffy?" "When you had children, and I forgot I have terrible taste in romantic partners," Miles says dryly, and pulls a familiar bottle of wine out of his battered knapsack. "Are we saving any?" "I'm sure Arla and Django will find a restaurant and be back eventually," Jaster says, philosophical. "They mentioned exploring, too, so he doesn't have high hopes they'll return with their spoils anytime soon." Miles chuckles. "No sharing, then," he says, and behind him, the saxophones fade away, the woman's voice replacing them.
The temple's urban design director, Tarasa, will be hosting this month's trivia night at Dex's Diner. All are welcome to attend. All participants of the trivia night will receive a free front yard makeover. This is not optional. Tarasa would also like to remind everyone that lawns are emblematic of a skewed relationship to the land, and she says she cannot be held responsible for anything that happens to those who refuse to see these sterile, monotonous, and flagrantly wasteful expanses of turf to the wild nature from whence they came. Doors open at 8, but Dex advises participants to get there early to save the best seats.
Jester stares at the radio, not entirely able to believe his ears. "It's called humor, Jaster," Miles says pityingly, "and hers is impeccable. You wouldn't understand."
"Before we go, let me leave you with this breaking news,"
the woman says, unflinching in the face of Jaster's incredulity that this is an actual news broadcast.
"Officer Vos, who prefers to be called Quinlan, says there is a new historian in our sleepy little town. Isn't that splendid? Professor Jaster Muriel, PhD, 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 will be studying the remnants of the Sith cult in Corbin Canyon. Everyone here at the Temple Community Radio Station would like to wish him the best with his research, and I, for one, certainly hope all the Sith are truly dead. But you know how persistent history is, listener. Perhaps, if the professor is lucky, he might even find a Jedi to go along with all the Sith he's sure to rouse from their eternity of torment when he ventures into funerary wastes. One must hold out hope. Always, always, there is hope."
Jaster stares at Miles, who blinks back in what Jaster personally thinks is not nearly enough consternation, and they both turn to look at the radio.
"Listeners, I thank you for having hope with me this night,"
the woman says.
"I am Faye, and you are loved, and there is hope in this vast darkness that falls to swallow us from the deepest space. Keep one candle burning tonight. Don't let it go out. And dream, listener. Dream of hope. Good night."
Jaster reaches over and decisively turns the radio all the way off. When Miles opens his mouth to protest, Jaster gives him a long, pointed stare, and Miles slowly closes his mouth. They finish the wine between them, and when they stagger to beds on the floor sometime around midnight, Jaster is tired enough that he doesn't even comment on Miles lighting one of the emergency candles and leaving it in the very center of the kitchen island. When he wakes up, it's still burning. The end.